Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
The Department of Special Collections is the part of UCLA's library responsible for rare books, manuscript collections, historic photographs, and other rare and special objects. Our department has one of the largest collections in the state of California of manuscript materials and other things too, but particularly of manuscript collections. We have more than 1,700 collections, but that might not sound like such a huge number until you understand that, in fact, some of these collections are scores or even thousands of boxes. We store these collections in a big facility on the campus. We have two floors in this building. Each of the floors is the size of a football field. And no university library really has the resources to keep up with this valuable material. So, faced with this problem and the great backlog that we were developing of fantastic holdings, it occurred to me that a solution might be to involve graduate students who are already at a fairly advanced level of their studies, who have maybe language expertise in addition to subject expertise, and pair them up with some of these collections so that we would be able to draw on their knowledge. We would share our knowledge of how to approach the cataloging and description. They would have first crack at this material that no one else has seen and thereby find an original topic for their dissertations or theses or an article. And in this way, everyone wins.
When you open up a box of stuff that's totally unwieldy, that's never been processed before, and there's no telling what's going to be in there. What first attracted me to the center was the idea that I could merge my film background with new skills I was developing in library school. And so what started out as kind of an interest in archival film, restoring film, preserving film, moved into manuscripts and photographs and different sorts of media. Not only do I have a comfort around archives, which I think a lot of graduate students don't, graduate students go into research and archives and you're scared if you've never been in one before and you don't know how things work. So this is like my home. This is a very comfortable situation for me. It's not terrifying at all. And I made friendships and professional relationships that have helped me out to this day.
We have a trained archivist librarian, currently Kelly Buckley, who oversees the center.
What I would suggest is putting Mylar around this, and that way when people in the reading room handle this, they won't get the red rot all over their hands. So that would be great protection for the book.
She works with each student, helps them understand what goes into doing professional level archival description, and brings every project to fruition. This is what makes it a very robust model.
So this letter I came across and I basically just had no idea what it was because it's indecipherable. And so I went to Kelly and asked her, what is this? And she said, well, it's an example of cross-writing. It's a saved paper. It's actually written across and then written this way. It took a little bit of effort to read, but it was really interesting. I'm working on the 18th century printing publishing industry, and so a whole part of this collection is letters from booksellers. So I can figure out exactly where they were located in London at the time, see the types of things they were writing to their clients, what their clients were writing to them, authors or people who are doing binding. So I really feel like I have more of a grasp on this world that I'm writing about in my dissertation.
Projects are selected based on two major criteria. One is the student's knowledge and expertise that they would be bringing to the project, and the other is the demand or research value of the collection. Many collections have been sitting for decades untouched. Recently, we were able to process a collection of Tanzanian newspapers that was donated by a political science faculty member.
This would have been a donation that I made sometime in the mid to late 1960s. 40 years later, I was contacted by the center and told that the Zanzibar collection was back on again.
A Tanzanian graduate student applied to work in the center specifically to process that collection.
Janet Kaaya made it her project. And the fact that it's so well done, so well cataloged, and so accessible adds to the thrill of this having happened after that 40-year period.
When we were envisioning the center, we felt that it would be important to compensate the students well at a rate equivalent to, say, a TA-ship or a research assistantship, recognizing their special skills.
We've had one student, Carolyn Luce, who has been working on the Western States Jewish Archive, an immense collection of unprocessed, uncatalogued materials. In one of those folders, in one of those 186 boxes, she found material about the history of the bagel that actually has blossomed into what I think will be a really wonderful dissertation.
This is really delicate and really big.
And even those students who don't find their topic while working at the center benefit immensely because they know how to work in an archive, knowing how to use finding aids because they've developed their own finding aids for other collections. All of these skills pay off, and pay off considerably in terms of reducing the time to degree.
One of the things that I always tried to keep in mind is, what are the needs of researchers, especially somebody who's going to be looking at this finding aid online and who's trying to figure out whether they want to make a trip all the way out to California. I try to be as descriptive as possible, but also efficient with time. One of my future goals is to become a university-level professor. And in processing these collections, I started to consider possible assignments for students, trying to get them familiar with university archives, delving into manuscripts, documents, ephemera, things that they wouldn't get out of published books necessarily, give them a sense of how history is really alive.
We constantly have new collections coming in, and we keep many of them down here. Here's a collection that we literally just received yesterday in this very box, all beat up. And it's a collection of artifacts from Kenya, from Barack Obama's supporters in Kenya. Kenya says, yes, we can. This is a collection of glass plates from a landscape architect named Huntsman Trout. And here's a photograph of a design he did for a very elaborate garden. But this is why we have hidden collections, because we just have so many coming in all the time.
With over 1,000 unprocessed collections, and many of them being quite large, we've decided to try a new approach with the Roger Menavee collection. This collection has over 2,100 boxes. French and Francophone studies student Matthew Callahan has started to describe this collection. Normally, when we describe a collection, we're describing each folder. But with this collection, to actually get through more material, we're describing each box.
I've been working for about 3.5 months on the collection. I've processed about 1,100 boxes, and I've got about 1,000 ahead of me, so I figure I'm about halfway done. This is box 1,326, and we have quite a few really interesting things regarding anti-Semitism and the Holocaust. Probably what excites me the most about this box is finding these items that we'll never really see again if we don't document them and keep them for posterity.
surprising and wonderful outcomes of the center that we've seen over and over again is that as soon as these collections get processed and they're available online, we have people at our door dying to use them.
Before I came to the center, I had never touched a tablet before. At the center, my job was to describe and translate a collection of 34 cuneiform tablets, which are the oldest items in special collections. Cuneiform is the oldest writing system invented by humans around 3400 BC. Cuneiform tablets are made out of clay, which was a very abundant resource in ancient Mesopotamia. The collection has mainly two types of tablets, receipts and writing exercises from the world's first schools. This receipt is the oldest item in special collections, which is over 4,000 years old, and it records 19 fat sheep, 10 male goats that were given as an offering to King Shulgi from a man named Nalu in the city of Ur. This was done by a beginner student just learning the basic nouns for the writing system. In the first column, the teacher wrote out signs to be copied by the beginner student. In the second column, we see the student's work. Here we see the basic nouns for fly, dog, and fig, which were also copied on the reverse. This drawing was done by a student in scribal school, which tells us that scribes had to work at refining their hand, both with their sign practice and with drawing technique. As a teaching assistant, I was able to use my training from the center to create a class with fellow graduate students.
All right, you guys, so what we're gonna do today is actually make our own little cuneiform tablets. And I have given each of you your own individual cuneiform exercise.
This is like playing Operation.
There are no lazy scribes. It became very obvious to my students that a scribe needed many years of training in order to become very precise and consistent. My experience here at the center ties in very closely with my career goals. I plan to work in a museum with unpublished collections of cuneiform tablets. One of the benefits of working at the center is the ability to develop technical skills in my field. For example, I was able to work on line art, which is the rendering of signs from the tablet into a black and white drawing, which makes it easier for a non-specialist to read. There are tens of thousands of cuneiform tablets that still need to be translated. My goal is to continue working with hidden collections using everything that I learned here at the center.
Working at the center was interesting because I'd never actually been able to work on these primary documents firsthand. I've heard about them from my advisor who has worked on, you know, colonial Mexican manuscripts, but it seemed very abstract. So the actual opportunity of getting to handle some of these huge volumes, I'm thinking in particular of these famine manuscripts, so big, just the size of them, so large. It's really a privilege to be able to say, oh, I've touched this stuff. I know what it smells like. I know what it feels like. It's certainly a different experience when everything's become so digital, where we can download all these images. To be able to actually touch these objects is pretty remarkable opportunity. This document is actually a notarial document from the city of Puebla de Los Angeles, which is my hometown. And to find these three contracts from my hometown from the period I study, which is the 1580s to the 1640s, as a grad student, that's all you can really ask for. Puebla de Los Angeles dates from 1531, so there are a lot of signs. When I was younger, we'd be walking down the street at every corner or at every half block. I had to read everything. I had to read everything, no matter where we were. And so Puebla de Los Angeles allows a historically oriented child to grow and to absorb. It's wonderful to be able to walk through one city and understand all the layers of events that took place in that space. I'm very proud to be a poblano, which is what we call ourselves, and to have been able to read all those signs. The more I read documents here, the more I process them, the easier it is to go to Puebla and be able to understand what the Puebla scribes are putting down on 16th century paper. Two very different documents. They're both notarial documents, but what we see immediately is how different the handwriting is. In this case, we have a very formal kind of stylized writing. It's very neat, it's very crisp, really beautiful, actually. And of course, the signature of the interested party and then of the actual scribe. Whereas this is a purchase of a large amount of corn, of maize. And when you talk about everyday transactions, things tend to get sloppy. A lot of abbreviations, that's part of what makes this handwriting so difficult to interpret. So it's a perfect example of the kind of practice we get here as researchers. And my ultimate goal now is to be able to go back to Mexico and teach at the university level there, to reinvest. I would like everything I've learned to have an impact in Mexico, where I think there's a great need for this kind of scholarship.
When working with the Obama materials, I spoke with Ruby Bell Gam, the library's African Studies subject specialist who acquired the collection.
I wanted us to get some tangible memorabilia, to get a taste of what it was like for Kenyans on that day. So we ordered them from the Library of Congress office in Nairobi. And here we have a rear view mirror hanger. And obviously, the person who made this didn't check to see how the president spells his name. There was an earlier version of this beer called the Senator. So this is a step up.
And it's interesting that even though they don't mention Obama's name at all, people know the connection and they actually call it the Obama.
This is called a kanga, and that's in Swahili. Congratulations, Barack Obama. Upendo na amani ametujalia Mungu. God has granted us love and peace.
Something like this shouldn't be folded. What will happen over time, and you'll see as we unfold this, that there's creases, and at some point they will break the cloth. It's done with permatan, and it has white permalife paper on it, both acid-free, so that it won't affect the actual material. You kind of want to roll it so it's not really tight.
Okay.
Just make sure it should be very loose. Slipping it into the box that it goes into. So that's one item done.
Between the summer of my first and second years, I worked in the center processing archival collections, including the papers of Miriam Matthews, the first certified African-American librarian in California. I didn't know who Miriam Matthews was before I processed her papers. When I was looking at working for the center, I was drawn to her work by all the things she had done. She was an independent historian documenting African-Americans in California and Los Angeles. Thank you. One of the things that inspired me about Miriam Matthews' life was seeing her involvement as a librarian raising awareness about African American history and culture. She would often have programs at her library bringing in artists and poets like Calvin Bailey and Langston Hughes to speak to the community about the work that they were doing. Processing these two collections has made me think about bringing these sorts of materials to light so that they aren't always put on a shelf somewhere, so that everyone has a chance to learn about them and learn from them. Based on my experiences at the center, I decided to pursue a second master's degree in public humanities and also learn ways to help the public understand and interpret primary source materials.
At the end of the summer of 2004, I received an email about the Center for Primary Research Training that said they're looking for people who have the language skills, can do Arabic, Persian, or Turkish, and also some paleographic training if they have any. So I wrote back and I said I could do Persian, Arabic, and Turkish, not or, but and. And I had just finished a course in Turkey on Ottoman paleography. I guess that I probably knew a lot of the text. First of all, I didn't know that UCLA is one of the two largest repositories of Near Eastern manuscripts in the U.S. And we have somewhere around 8,000 to 10,000 volumes. So the sheer number to me was shocking.
Ya man bi sultanihi yantasiru al-mazlumu wa bi'aunihi ya'tasimu maklumu.
Sabaqat mashiyataku. When you look at a manuscript, there's a lot of detective work you have to do, which you didn't know. So how do I pick up this manuscript, look at the spine, or look at the first word and try to figure out what this is about or what kind of political or religious affiliation does the author have? How to use marginalia for finding out what kind of text we're dealing with in a hand that you're not familiar with and you're processing fast. So all of that I learned here. What was great about the manuscripts that I had processed was that I could combine the cataloging and the research that I had done with a kind of a teaching presentation. This is a list of famous cities and their distance from other important places. And then this is the distance of Tibet to Mecca or to Somnath in India or to Kashmir, right? And then it's got these digits at the top that tell you what the distance is from Tibet to those places, and this is Kashmir to whatever, Constantinople, etc. A lot of these books, you have the original manuscript, but then the title's torn off, and then somebody redid it in the 20th century or 19th century, and so you don't have the original leather cover. But this one, you actually have the original binding, and you could tell from the way that it's actually sewed to the back. Also from the drawings, the illustrations, they depict contemporary dress. This is, would be a 17th century Safavid in what is today Iran. And you got another one on this side. And they have a little partridge on the inside, which is kind of nice. And actually the title's on there. It's called Kanz al-Lughat, which is the treasury of words. It's an Arabic to Persian dictionary. I don't have a copy of these here, but occasionally you find grocery lists. And then you find things like, on such and such day, my daughter so-and-so was born, light of my eyes, may she live to a natural life. So what does the book tell us besides the content? Even if it's the 150th copy of this text, the text is still valuable because it has personal information. I realized, having worked here, that the teaching part is what I feel more strongly drawn toward. The things that I learn here are very useful to me now. I can do research and find things out in the way that my colleagues can't. I think a lot of the sort of nitty-gritty of research that you have to learn to be able to really do proper research, you don't learn that as thoroughly in a history department or another department as you would working in a library.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.